Shauna Meyerson with Yoga Athletica in Los Angeles, California, or more technically today, we are coming live from, hold on 1 second, let's turn off the volume on this one. Sorry about that. More specifically, live from Santa Monica, California today with Michelle Mazur. Michelle is an expert in the Bhagavad Gita, which I wish I were too, but I'm not. So I'm going to refer to her tonight. She's going to start off by giving us sort of an overview, a summary of the Bhagavad Gita, if you're not familiar with the text. And then we're going to be speaking tonight about its implications for the war in the Middle East. Of course, there's a lot of complication, a lot of complexity surrounding the Gaza-Israeli war. And particularly as yogis, we have concerns about ahimsa and about like what does war mean? And is it something that's meant to be engaged in or avoided? And if you're not familiar with the Bhagavad Gita, the whole thing really centers around the very concept of a war, really between a family. And I always find this very interesting because if you really want to look at Judaism and Islam, they're family, right? I mean, we're talking about Ishmael and Isaac were the two children of Abraham. Both Bibles say that, the Quran and the Torah,
right?
You know, they don't disagree.
Right.
Ultimately, even in the broader sense than just like, oh, human beings are brothers and sisters, like Muslims and Jews really...
Oh, they really are.
Brothers and sisters.
They go back. They're the Abrahamic religions. And they go back and they're basically very similar. But things have gone on over the years.
Yeah. But in the context of sort of like a war between families, I want to just tell you something really funny is that when I was growing up, I went to Jewish school as a child. I went to Orthodox Jewish school.
Wow.
And not only was the state of Israel very, very prominent in my studies, but what was interesting is that despite talking about Israel a lot, I didn't even know there was a war. I didn't know there was an enemy. And the funny thing is that when the only way that Muslims were ever referred to in our school was as our Muslim brothers and sisters. And growing up into an embarrassingly old age, I must have been probably close to my teens, I literally thought that there were two major religions. There was Christianity, and then there was Jewish slash Muslim, and that we were, for some reason in my head, I thought we were like the same religion for some reason. So anyway, that's just a funny side note.
Yeah, but that's a shame that your school presented it that way.
It's not that they presented it that way. It's just that it was just when you're a kid and you hear our Muslim brothers and sisters, you know, I just thought, oh, okay, well, we're with them. And then there's Christians, and those are the two religions.
And everyone's worshiping in the same building.
Or something. I don't know what I thought. But it was just funny. But yeah, they are Abrahamic religions. And it is interesting that we do come from the same place. So that being said, in the context of the Bhagavad Gita is a war between family. And if you don't mind, can you give us just a basic overview?
First of all, I'm not an expert. I don't call myself that in any way, shape, or means. I'm just passionate about the Bhagavad Gita and been to school a lot to take classes and discussions and lectures. So I think it is the most wonderful book ever written. Even better than the Bible, because it's so easy to live the Bhagavad Gita and see it in your life. It's so easy to bring it into how you make your decisions and who you decide to associate with and how you feel about people you don't like. So the Bhagavad Gita is a story, and that makes it easier to understand. It's a story about basically good and evil, and the reason it was written, it's because we as humans, I don't care who you are, where you live, what you or who you worship, we all have conflict in our head all the time. It's just part of our life. Even children have conflicts. Should I go on the monkey bars or should I go on the swings? Okay? So it's really just, how do we get out of the conflict in our head? It sounds so trivial, but we really do live in that place. I am supposed to be looking there,
yeah.
Right? Okay. We really do live in that place of decision making. I mean, I could think of more time in my life that I spend in my head trying to figure out, should I call her? Should I not call her? He wasn't nice to me. She almost tripped me. She didn't invite me to that party and he didn't do this. And this is just on a superficial level what we go through. So the Bhagavad Gita is a story about Krishna, and Krishna is playing the Almighty, the Divine, God, whatever your name is for a higher entity. Okay, I don't want to pick one. You pick your own. So Krishna is this supreme being, supreme Atman, and he tells a story about a war. And before we even come to the war, there's two kingdoms, two separate kingdoms, and they're cousins that are actually the two heads of each kingdom. And one kingdom has less people in it, and is the head of the kingdom is very wise. He's very wise, and he's very, not just kind,
moral.
Yeah, he's moral. He's diplomatic. He knows how to take care of his people, and he does it righteously with all the different ways a really good leader would behave. And then we have the other kingdom, who happens to be some of his cousins, some of his school friends from when he was growing up, some of his teachers, maybe a few uncles are in the other kingdom. And that kingdom doesn't do that well. They're not really led by somebody who's very righteous. This person has less morals. This person does things that are not appropriate. So there's these two sides. And what do you do when two sides don't agree? You go to war, just like we do in the world today. Not saying it's right, not saying it's wrong at this moment, but we go to war. And goodness me, how do you go to war when the leader of one of the kingdoms is so righteous that he says, I cannot kill. I was not taught to kill. I was not taught to harm. I don't know how we're going to get out of this one, but the other side was not only harmful, they hurt the women when they would pillage the other towns. I'm a little nervous. And a lot of bad things were happening on one side, and really nice things were happening on the other. So we have two kingdoms, and they're completely different, and the rulers of the kingdoms are totally different. So the ruler of the better side, the side we're rooting for, okay, that's a good way of putting it, I guess, is a man named Arjuna. And Arjuna is full of light. He's just an amazing human being. and the other ruler is full of darkness. So they don't really know what to do. There's a lot of chapters going on, chapter after chapter after chapter, about the despondency of Arjuna. I can't kill, I can't harm. This is what I was taught by my parents. I cannot do anything bad. And the other side said, I'm in it. I'm gonna go for it. So these two leaders decide that they're going to go to Krishna. And Krishna's gonna help them decide how they're to do this battle. Now, mind you, many chapters are going by because they're introducing the brothers, the cousins, the uncles, the teachers, the people, and they all have these very, very long Indian names, and I cannot really pronounce them, so I don't even say them.
It's sort of like the Bible in the beginning, where it's like, this person begat this person, there were five sons and three nephews.
It really is like that.
Yeah.
And in the beginning, they're comparing the bad side to the good side. So not so different than what we do in our head, if you think about it. So these two guys go to Krishna. Now, who is Krishna? Krishna is God who came down or from wherever and put himself in a human form. Because if he came in an angel or a ghost or another form, most anyone would be frightened of him. So he came down in a human form. So he would be recognized as a human and nobody would be scared of him. So they're both sitting before Krishna and they explain the story of this battle that they want to have. Now Krishna knows the story, of course, okay? He's the divine being. So the first one to get in front of Krishna is the other side, the darker side, who owns that kingdom. He says, Krishna, I want horses, and I want chariots, and I want swords, and I want armor, and I want thousands and thousands of warriors, and I will surely win. And Krishna says, fine, you could have that. And then Arjuna goes in front of Krishna, and he's down on his knees and he says, sir, I would gladly have you. You are God, you are the divine, you are the supreme being. Of course I want you on my side. So Krishna says, fine, I'm speeding it up already because it's a big book.
If I can just mention something here and correct me if I'm wrong. I believe what happened at this juncture, just not that that didn't happen, but was that Krishna said to the two leaders, you can either have these hundreds of thousands of men and the beasts.
Yes, he did.
But there's that twist because, or you could have me.
Right.
And
yes,
I don't even remember the other guy's name because he's like the other guy.
It's a long, I can't say it.
So Krishna said that I'm going to allow Arjuna to choose first. And the other guy is like, well, that's not fair. I'm older. I'm this and that. I should go to
the
chapter.
That's in the chapters. There's a lot of those chapters.
But that Arjuna, because the other guy is like, well, of course, because you have the choice between either the men, the whip, the weapons, the animals, or this old guy.
Right.
He's like, of course Arjuna is going to choose all the weapons and this and that.
Not Arjuna, the other one.
No, the other one said, of course Arjuna will choose that. And Krishna said, well, no, Arjuna gets to choose first. And he stuck to his guns, and Arjuna had the choice, and he decided he wanted God on his side.
Of course he did. Because he's Arjuna, he's righteous, he's the righteous one, okay? But as the story goes, he still doesn't want any war because he doesn't kill, he doesn't harm, he doesn't do any of that. So the divine being Krishna at this point is getting a little, you know, he's getting a little like when a child doesn't listen to its mother and the mother's been on the kid over and over and over again. So what happens is Krishna keeps telling Arjuna, Arjuna, you have a responsibility to do your dharma. And Arjuna keeps saying, no, I can't, I will not. You know, think about your own life and your own issues and your own problems. This goes on in your head all the time.
Can you define dharma really quickly?
Oh, I will. Your dharma is your responsibility in life. So for example, I'm a mother, I'm a girlfriend, I'm a wife.
Not my girlfriend. You sort of just gestured.
I'm a wife, I'm a mother, I'm a grandmother. I have all these responsibilities that I take very seriously, but I have one essential dharma. One essential, and so does every single person on this earth. And what is mine? Not that you asked, but I love, since I was a little girl, to help people. I love to help people. I can tell when somebody's sad and hurt and lonely, and I just am that person. And I pretty much devoted my life, even in my yoga teaching, to help people in more ways than just teaching them Warrior Two and Trikonasana. So I feel that is my essential dharma. So now everybody, according to Krishna, has an essential dharma. But you already know that, I think. I'm sure everybody out there is smart enough to know that. So where was I?
So Arjuna really doesn't want to fight, and he's telling him, Krishna is telling him, like a bad child, he's not listening.
Right.
You have to go out because it's your dharma.
Right. It is your responsibility. He even says a few nasty things to Arjuna in one of those middle chapters where Krishna's getting really frustrated. Like, he's had enough. So basically, he says, okay, Arjuna, you're going to get it. I don't normally do this to anyone, but I'm going to do this now because you need to learn your lessons. I am going to show you who I am. So that's basically a Godhead telling a human, I'm going to show you my powers. And Krishna does, I think it's two or three chapters on his powers and shows Arjuna who he is. And it starts out with Arjuna sees the brightness of a sun that was 50 times more powerful and bigger and brighter than the sun we have in the sky. He started hearing everything from the very first sound on earth to the sounds that are going to be on earth in the infinite time. Everything that's possible, dragon heads with smoke, with fire, with rivers, with waters, I'm surprised no one's really done a movie on it, but.
They have, actually.
They have.
So not only is there a Bhagavad Gita like movie, but I think I was mentioning to you, there's a movie from, I think, the 80s that's called The Legend of Bagger Vance. And it's actually just like a normal American movie.
Oh, okay.
And it's an interpretation of, like, a modern American interpretation of the Bhagavad Gita.
Cool.
Yeah.
Cool.
I haven't seen it.
But I do remember the name of that movie. I didn't know it was anything like that.
Yeah.
This is not really so Krishna can scare Arjuna. Because Arjuna is so despondent, he doesn't listen. He doesn't listen. And he doesn't want to. And Krishna keeps saying, you must do your duty. Your duty is your dharma, your responsibility. So now, There is something called an ajna dharma, which is so essential to your being, to who you are, to how you live your life and your lives after that. So Krishna is showing Arjuna all this power, I mean, beyond anything you could even imagine. And at this point, Krishna's supposedly, it says in the book, his hair stands up on his head and he's on the floor lying on his stomach, prostrating. Like, how could he dare say no to God? How did I argue with him? Like, who am I? And so he's so ashamed of himself and he's angry at himself. So at that point, there's silence on two sides of the battlefield. One side has, I think they say, a million horsemen and swords and everything that goes with it. And on the other side, they have a chariot. And the chariot driver is Krishna. And Arjuna is in the back seat. So we have one little chariot there with God. And then we have
we know how this is going to end.
Okay. So what it says in the book is that, of course, Krishna annihilates the other side. And it just shows that good over evil. But what is the purpose of this story? I mean, it's about taking on your responsibility. Yes, in yoga world, we call it dharma. A lot of people use the word dharma, but not everybody knows what that means. It's what is your responsibility in your life that's a little greater than being a wife, mother, friend? What's your spark, your essentialness? Who are you? Why were you put on this earth? Why do you breathe air? So I find the story to be so empowering because we don't like war. Nobody likes war. Nobody wants killing. Nobody wants anything like that. But maybe sometimes it has to be, because you have to protect your home. You have to protect your children. You have to protect your parents. You have responsibilities. So sometimes a war has to be fought.
Yeah. And so obviously the Bhagavad Gita on the surface is talking about an actual war. It's really talking about the war of the spirit, of the, as you're saying, of the internal guide to that being the battle of life. But I want to shift back to the actual whatever war metaphor, which is really what the whole book is a big metaphor for our internal struggles through an external battle. Because first of all, speaking on the topic of dharma, when we're talking about a moral imperative, we hear these words a lot, and we don't really think of it that much. Like, oh, it's the moral imperative, but imperative means something you must do, okay, because it has certain moral implications. And so when Krishna told Arjuna, I don't care if you don't want to fight, you have to fight, really it was because if he didn't fight, then he is putting his own nation at risk.
Absolutely.
And so when you talk about responsibility to humans, to humanity, you're not saving the world by letting your enemy get away with whatever enemies want to get away with at the expense of your own nation.
Right?
And especially because he represented sort of the goodness, the kindness.
He was designed by Krishna, as every other human being was. You know, and this goes back to what everybody's beliefs are, and I'm trying to go over that and just make this a story about everybody in their life and how they think and how they operate. And all the time we waste in our brains on nonsense, not being able to make decisions. But Krishna does say, he does say in the book, at the end of your day, you won't be able to come to me unless you have lived your dharma. So that could be a religious connotation, and you know, I don't want to even go there. But if you think about it, anybody who lives a full life, at the end of their day, whatever age that's going to be, it has to feel better to know that you lived your responsibilities,
right,
than not.
Right.
So you don't have, oh my goodness, I should have done that. I should have befriended so-and-so who I didn't talk to
right,
for years.
Right.
So I think that has so much to do with the book.
Yeah. So I really, like, if today, if like CNN were like reporting on that war, they'd be like 770,000 people died on one side and no one died on the other side. And therefore, it must be the one that lost 770, that's the good side, because they took all the losses. And honestly, that's not reality. That you can be on the side of good and the side of power.
Absolutely, because sometimes we have to battle. Sometimes we have to confront the plumber who charged us five times more than it cost to put in a new sink, okay? We have to go to battle because it was unjust.
Right.
This is life, but there's a way to go to battle.
Right.
There's a way not to.
Right. And so in the framework of this Gaza war, and obviously, as everybody knows, this is complex and in a long-standing thing, we have Hamas coming into Israel, committing atrocities that everyone's saying we haven't seen since the Holocaust. We didn't even see them in the Holocaust. What they did to the Israeli population on October 7th was, the brutality defies any ounce of humanity, any ounce of decency, any ounce. Like, I think about, you know, there are a lot of, like, apologists who are like, oh, well, they deserved it because Israel, whatever. I'm not going to get into those politics, but let's say Israel was everything that they're accused of being, which, don't get me started, they're not, and maybe we can get into some of those lies and propaganda later, maybe, but that's not really what this is about. But let's say that they did. Like, could you imagine if after George Floyd, the response of the African American or Black, depending on how you look at it, community, was to go into neighborhoods and bake babies alive,
right,
and cut babies out of women's stomachs,
right,
and shoot women with Alzheimer's in the head, and in do these horrific, like, there's nothing, nothing. Like, there's nothing. You could come, I mean, don't, but if you came and killed my family, I still wouldn't do this stuff. Like,
right,
you have to be
right,
a beast,
right, right,
to do that kind of thing. And so there are so many people who in the yoga community who are screaming, ahimsa, ahimsa, Israel must back off, Israel can't go in, Israel is this, Israel is that. And again, I do want to come back to that. I understand how the numbers look, but Arjuna killed 770,000 people, I think it's something like that, making up a number, to zero. And I like sometimes things are black and white.
Sometimes.
Like, nobody said to the allies, you know what? do sort of what you need to do, but let's just keep it low key. Let's make sure that nobody's hurt in the process. And millions of civilian casualties because they were facing the ultimate evil.
Right.
And that's what Israel is facing today.
Right. Right. Sometimes there is a responsibility to fight. Israel was hurt, and it's in so many things on planet Earth. There's so many times when a war is all you can do. If somebody comes into your village and rapes all the women and kills all the children and steals the babies and slaughters everyone, do you sit there? I mean,
yeah. Where would be the ahimsa there? You can't have ahimsa with barbarians, because then you wind up with a bunch of dead people with ahimsa.
Ahimsa just means non-harming, but if you don't pick up and fight, sometimes that's the non-harming.
Yeah. And it's interesting also, when we think about in the Bhagavad Gita, that Arjuna chooses God. He chooses God. And I don't want this to be like super religious, but if you look at the history of the Jewish state, to say that it's a miracle that there is a Jewish state, not only that it exists, but the wars that within five hours of the founding of Israel, they were attacked by five countries. This is a brand new country with a scrappy military of just random people. And since then, it's been war after war perpetrated upon them from all their neighbors.
Just because people hate Jews, there's no reason. There's no reason other than that. It's not a reason, though.
It is. It that's exactly what it is. They don't want Jews in their neighborhood. It sounds familiar. But there's hardly anybody who has studied or followed the history of Israel who the word miracle does not show, like it will show up in everyone's like discourse. It's just a miracle. And it reminds me so that again, sometimes it seems like all they have on their side is God. And I'm not saying that God isn't on the other side, because God is everywhere, right? There are two different gods in theory, but as far as I'm concerned, there can only be one ubiquitous, all-powerful, omnipotent God. So it doesn't really matter what you call him, it's what you choose to offer him. Who are you when you are offering your dharma? Because your dharma, as far as I see it, is your offering to God. God gave you a life, and what are you giving in return?
Right. I just always believe in a higher entity, and my responsibility is to serve.
Right.
And it could be just smiling to an old person on a bench who looks so sad.
Right.
It could be opening the door for a pregnant woman. Serving is just part of life, and to me, that's one of the most important things. And I think this book, what am I trying to say? This book teaches action, and to perform something is performing an action. Sometimes in my life, before I studied all this stuff, I would sit back and wondering why this isn't happening and that isn't happening and this isn't. And then I didn't realize till I started studying Eastern philosophy that I'm not doing anything. I'm not performing an action. So sometimes when I'm teaching young people way younger than me, and they're all in this dilemma, like, and they're doing nothing, and they're going nowhere because they can't make up their mind, this, that, this. And I say, perform an action. It might not work, but do something. Do something. I learned that. I learned that from all my teachers. And I pass it on. Do something. Do it righteously.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say. Don't just do something. Do the right thing.
Do the right thing. And, you know, the right thing might waver with different people.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting because, so when we talk about yoga, right, the world that we live in is a world of dichotomy, of Maya, of illusion.
Yeah.
So why would everything that we experience be Maya? Why would it be illusion? Because we are colored by our experiences and our knowledge, okay? And there's no way for me to, like, pretend I don't know what I do know, or that I haven't experienced what I have experienced. And so, in a world of dichotomy, like, we tend to think of, like, I'm going to use the most basic one, black and white, okay?
Most basic.
Okay? But we all know that there is, black and white is a continuum. Right, like I can even say, like right here, your wall, I would say it's white. It's not. Nobody paints their wall white. There's always like a tint of whether it's tan, whether it's black, you know, whatever. And so the question is, like, when does black become white? Or when does it even become gray? So everything is very, very blurry, right, in a world of dichotomy, right? And so we need to, as much as possible, try to take, I think, and tell me if you disagree, that largely emotion is what blurs fact.
Of course, because emotion is caught in your head. What is our head? Our head is one big illusion, you know. Shauna and I could be sitting here watching the same exact thing. She thinks something completely different than me. Now, how could that be if it's only we saw what we saw?
Right.
So it's what you decipher in your head, and that's part of the problem. Well, you know, going deeper into yoga, which we're not, I mean, we're trying to separate Purusha and Prakriti, but we're not teaching yoga here.
But
you know, Purusha is where you're seeing with your pure consciousness, hopefully,
right,
and you can see clearly because you've calmed down.
Right.
Here you're thinking through your crazy head, which is the whole entire book of the Bhagavad Gita. I don't want to fight.
Right.
But when his understanding of the situation gets here to his heart center, to his soul, and he says, I will fight.
Right.
It's the right thing. That's my dharma.
Right. Because the things get blurred in the middle, but they're very clear on the poles. Like, like anybody, I'm sorry, I'm going to go ahead and say it. Anybody who excuses what Hamas did on October 7th on any level and for any reason has no moral compass. Period. End of story. Regardless of what happened after that day, there is no excuse for that kind of atrocity, and there is no way that Israel could not respond. It is their responsibility to their nation, who was, and it's so funny when, like, all over social media are like, oh, well, you're just playing the victim. I'm like, Israel's playing the victim? They had 1,400 people slaughtered in the most horrific ways that the human mind could even conceive of, and 240 plus hostages, the youngest one being 9 months old, the oldest one being around 90. Like, there's simply no black and white here. None. That is the black. And if you look at the Torah, right, it says that Israel is meant to be a light upon the nations. And that is a role that Israel takes very, very, very seriously.
Very seriously.
And I do want to address, like, that there's so many people are going to watch us, and they're like, really? Because 10,000 people were killed. Well, listen, A, Israel never celebrates the death of anyone. Anyone. It doesn't matter if they're Israeli, if they're Palestinian, if they're Lebanese. That's not the business that Israel is in. Second of all, Israel does more to protect the people of Gaza than Hamas. By a million times. Israel has literally gave 2.5 weeks notice, helped the people out, have opened humanitarian corridors, made 6 million, and I know that this is a very significant number if anybody knows anything about Judaism, 6 million phone calls to the people of Gaza and said, you need to get out. And people are saying that Israel is brutal, that Israel is inhuman. They literally, who does that? Right. Who in wartime drops millions of flyers and says, this is where we're going?
Because Israel has a responsibility.
That's
just
right.
Like in the book,
that's
which
right.
is trying to teach Arjuna about his responsibility.
That's right. And it's ironic that the world depends on Israel's morality. For example, they want Israel to call a ceasefire rather than Hamas
surrender
and give up their hostages. Why? Because Hamas would never surrender and give up their hostages because they're animals.
Right.
Israel would because they're humans. And the biggest irony that I find almost funny, not, I say almost because it's funny, not funny, hashtag funny, not funny, is that the very reason that Hamas uses its own citizens as human shields is because A, Hamas does not care about their civilians. Their story is bolstered when more people die. But the funny thing is, they're using human shields because they know it will deter Israel. Because Israel cares. Israel cares about the citizens of
Gaza. We don't blow each other up.
But if they didn't care about the human shields, then Israel would be like, all right, 2 for 1.
Israel has a responsibility to live righteously.
That's right.
That was the law that was given to Israel at the time of Moses. Really.
That's right. And there is righteous battle.
That's right.
Absolutely.
That's right.
And in when Israel fights the righteous battle, all people see is this huge, mighty David versus, you know, like this Israel is smaller than
Israel is not huge and mighty. They're tiny.
It's tiny. And people like don't seem to understand that if they did not act with the kind of force that they did,
they'd be dead.
But let's even like these things where people are like, oh, well, they're genocidal. Well, first of all, if Israel wanted Gaza gone,
it would have been gone.
Five seconds.
That's right.
5 seconds. I mean, Israel has a nuclear bomb. If they wanted to get rid of Gaza, 5 seconds. And by the way, even this war incursion, I mean, the ground incursion that's happening right now, Israel is risking its own soldiers' lives by doing a ground incursion.
Oh, for sure.
They could just do it by air, bomb the crap out of Gaza, flatten everything, kill everyone, game over, we're done, we win, and everything is good. And by the way, if Hamas had the ability to do that to Israel,
they would have done it.
They try to do it. I mean, they send thousands and thousands and thousands of rockets, not to minimize civilian casualties, but to maximize them. There is zero moral equivalency between the way that Israel fights and the way that Hamas fights.
It's the book. It's the same thing as the Gita. It's the same thing. And by the way, Gita, Bhagavad Gita in English means the song of the Blessed One.
Right. So So if you could clarify, so I was hearing, so a Gita is a song, but it's more than a song, right? It's a song that is a calling, right? A song that it's commands?
I look at it as the great lesson. Mm-hmm. That's just how I see it. You know, I think anybody who reads the book or studies it, you can go to different universities and take courses on the Gita. I think everybody feels a little differently, but everybody loves it.
I mean, every
single person I've ever been in class with I studied at LMU, but everybody seems to love this book because you can relate.
Yeah.
You can so relate. Who has a mind that's clear all the time? Who performs an action, you know? It's kind of like the mother that doesn't discipline their children. They have
right.
wild, crazy children. So
right.
you have responsibilities and you must perform an action, but the
right,
right action.
That's right. That's right. I mean, Israel has never started a war or a conflict.
Israel would like to be left alone
right.
and live in peace. That's who they are.
That's right. It's always been defense.
Yeah.
And it's always only after they're pushed to the brink. Like, only after thousands of rockets are fired do they even respond.
I know.
Only after, I mean, what happened on October 7th is defies all morality, but in like they even wait until they are just pushed to the absolute edge before they even respond. I might even argue that they're like, when they behave like that, they're not fulfilling their dharma, because it's like, you've got thousands of rockets coming in on your people. How many more are you going to take? And they're like, I don't know, 7,000 more.
You know, I once had a talk with a rabbi that I know quite well. I was on my way to yoga, you know, and I bumped into a rabbi and we were talking, and I introduced myself and all that. And he said to me, you know that the Jewish people are the only people that don't try to convert?
Right.
Not only do we not convert, we let everyone in our congregation, and he was Orthodox.
Right. Yeah.
And that really pretty much blew me away. I knew we didn't convert, but as far as letting everyone in, just to hear it from a rabbi made a big deal. It was like, come people.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that really, I mean, ultimately, I could just say that, you know, growing up in a very, very Jewish environment, as we both did, peace. Everything was about peace. Everything we've ever done has been about peace. Everything we say, everything we sing. And Hamas, the leaders of Hamas, like, they have, like, they say it to our faces. They say it on our media. They say it out loud, and they're like, you know what? These people are dumb enough that they'll just laugh it off. And
but
like,
they train their children to kill
right.
Jews.
But what Hamas says flat out, the Jews value life and we value death. This is not my words, this is not interpretation.
Yeah, all of
this
these.
Is their exact words. And that's what it comes down to. We fight to save lives and they fight to destroy them. And in Judaism, we say that every life represents an entire universe. Well, because it does. And so if you were to take a life, you destroy a universe. And it doesn't say a Jewish life. It doesn't say an Israeli life.
It doesn't
life.
Say, it, of course not.
There are some very famous quotes, and I'm gonna, quotes, I'm gonna say them more or less, but Golda Meir, right, she said, I can forgive you for killing my boys, but I will never forgive you for forcing our boys to kill yours. And that is the Jewish spirit.
That is the Jewish spirit.
And that, you know, she also said very famously, when the Arabs start loving their children more than they hate ours,
right.
There will be no war. And then I'd like to also, and then we'll open it up to questions, hopefully there are people, and then if there's anything else you want to add. But what Bibi said, and I think it encapsulates everything in just so succinctly, and I'm sure that everybody's heard it by now, whether you believe it or not, as somebody who's been deeply, deeply entrenched in this conflict for more than 20 years, I've never heard anybody say more succinctly, if the Arabs put down their guns, there would be no more war. If we put down our guns, there will be no more Israel.
Right, that's right.
And if people can't understand that there is no moral equivalency.
Beautifully said.
It's just perfect. But there comes a point where if you test me, if you test my limits, if you threaten my nation, my dharma says, I must, I have no choice, I must fight back.
That's right.
Is there anything you'd like to add? And then we'll see if there's any questions. Okay.
We've covered everything.
Okay, cool. So I'm going to go here and see if we have any questions. Hey, Dinesh is here from India. Thank you so much, Dinesh. He's somebody who I talk to a lot on Instagram.
Hello.
And has been very very supportive of Israel. A lot of support coming from India. Because they have similar issues, very similar issues with the Islamists there. And what's interesting is the people who are not Islamic in India are basically Hindu, which means that the same texts, they are going by the same precepts, the same concepts of ahimsa, of kindness, of peace, and yet they choose the side of Israel. Why? Because we all are one. We all have the same concepts and the same beliefs. Hi, Aerialist Journey. I'm not sure who that is as a person. Bruh.
What?
Somebody said bruh.
Bruh.
B-R-U-H.
Like,
no, it's like brother.
Oh,
but
bro.
And then Eric. Hi, Shauna. This is Eric from Texas. Hey, Eric from Texas. So, does anybody have any questions that we can answer before we wrap this up? I'll give it just a few more minutes, or nothing's coming up. So this is like, when this happens, it's like Saturday Night Live.
I'm gonna add something.
Yes.
Which I forgot. I haven't taught the Gita for a while, so I'm rusty. What was I just about to say? Krishna makes it very clear to Arjuna that this performing your yajna is basically a sacrifice.
What's a yajna?
Performing, it's a sacrifice. It means that sometimes in order to see the higher reason of life or death or a god or a supreme being or whoever, whatever, in order to see the whole picture, there needs to be a sacrifice. Everybody has to sacrifice. And I don't mean like Jesus on the cross.
Right, right, right.
Nothing like that. But it's like the ultimate sacrifice, performing your yajna.
Right.
And this is in the Gita, I'm from New York. And it just poo-poo it, think of all the things you have to do and perform that really are similar to a sacrifice.
Yeah.
Because it's what you must do.
Right. I'm curious, in the Bhagavad Gita, can you recall, does Krishna say anything specifically about the loss of life on the other side?
Oh, of course he does.
What does he say
specifically? He says nobody dies, Arjuna. There's no such thing as death. This is Hindu, you know.
That's right. That's right. And when we don't fear death, we know that this body is just a shell.
It's just a shell to be reincarnated, and the soul lives forever, and that has, you know, nothing to do with the Israeli war with Hamas,
but it does to the extent of as human beings, I think we all hope to die in our sleep, right? Like, we just don't wake up one day, and then we come back as a baby, and everything's great. And it's hard for me, because I'm a big believer in fate, in fatalism, that there's a certain predetermined course that we're supposed to live in our lives. And that's very easy to reconcile when you're living a cushy life in Los Angeles, California. But how do we reconcile the fates of the gods with a 3-year-old being beheaded?
Oh.
I mean, what, like, so that's the big conflict.
No, then the conflict is, and I couldn't.
It's where everything breaks down for me.
It does for me too.
You know,
free will. Do we have it or don't we have it?
That's right. That's right. And I try so hard to. As Santosha says, we can't be victims of our circumstance.
Right.
We need to rise above it.
Right.
But at the same time, like, how do you even see something like this and rise above it? It's like I feel bad being happy or enjoying dinner with somebody or anything, because maybe there's like that element of, you know, that, you know, here but for the grace of God go I. Maybe it's like any of us could have been that victim, but nobody should suffer that fate.
Yeah. I don't know how you put that in your head and believe in this, that, and this and go forward. I don't know. It didn't happen to me.
Yeah.
I couldn't even comprehend, you know.
Yeah.
I know people who have lost children and children have committed suicide. I can't comprehend how they go on and how they feel.
So maybe that's a talk for another day, is just the, this is so off topic. Does everything happen for a reason? Because it's just like, as a woman of great faith, and I'm not even talking about, you know, just Jewish faith, just faith in the universe, these things question, they put everything into question, and it sort of,
well,
it tests us.
It's free will or not free will. You know, do you believe your life is going the way it was planned from the heavens, or do you believe you took detours because you wanted that, didn't want that, didn't care for that, went that way?
I'm also, sorry, God, boy, this is so off topic, but you introduced me to the story of the egg, which took me so long to really fully comprehend. I must have listened to it, I mean, easily 5 dozen times, just over and over and over again, because I liked the concept, I didn't understand it. But here's what's interesting, if the egg is true. that the universe exists for me and I am the universe. I'm everyone who has ever lived. It's almost, I'm thinking of this right now differently than I've ever thought of it. And boy, have I been thinking about this story. But I could almost take it as if everyone else and everything else exists only to teach me lessons. I can't prove that you exist outside of my imagination. I literally can't. I can't even prove that there's a single person on earth right now other than you.
But we're coming from one source of energy.
If right.
Einstein, all the great,
absolutely.
You know, one source of energy. So I am you and you are me and
100%. So what's Hamas?
So what's Hamas? They're us.
But how do I see God in that? Because I can't believe that God would, if we are godly beings, like it's almost, yeah, anyway.
Well, in the A, one of the questions, the person who's playing God, I know this has nothing to do with
one of the people
who's playing God, whether he's dressed like an old man with a beard, whatever, and the person who just died is saying, well, if there's only one, he's saying, I'm Abraham Lincoln,
yes.
And then he also says, and I'm Adolf Hitler, he says, yes. So then your mind starts to go.
Yeah. There are theories. So Satchidananda, I believe, is the one who, wasn't Satchidananda. It was near Neil Donald Walsh in Conversations with God, who says that everyone goes to heaven. Everyone.
And everyone goes to heaven, you think?
Including Hitler. And so wrapping your head around that concept, all systems break down.
That's why philosophers can sit in a room for days, weeks, months, and go, oh, would I love to be in that situation.
I don't know why their heads don't hurt. My head would explode.
I know, I love it.
Okay, well, it's been an hour, Michelle, and thank you so much for helping me to understand this book better and to really put into context some things that I know a lot of people on Earth are sort of struggling to wrap their minds around right now.
I know. They feel that we're condoning killing. I know that.
I know that you and I together and with the Jewish people and with the country of Israel that all we want is peace. And may all beings everywhere be happy and free. Loka, Samasta, Sukhino, Bhavantu. I think we'll leave it at that. If you have comments or questions, I think that you can leave comments even after the live feed is done, and Michelle and I will check and reply in kind. Well, me. Michelle doesn't know how to use technology.
No, I don't.
So, namaste. Thank you so much. And thank you, whoever joined us tonight, for joining us this evening. And I hope to talk to you again soon. Namaste.